Hello, my name is Tiff, and we have a few episodes lined up that aren't just going to take you around Australia. We're going to be talking to advocates and champions of the livestock industry around the world. We're catching up with young sheep producers thanks to the Next Generation Global Sheep Forum, and this has come about after a group of international sheep producer organisations around the world are collaborating. And the Next Generation program focuses on building capacity, capability of the next generation of sheep farmers and encouraging and inspiring young people to get into and stay in the sheep industry and to network globally. This conversation is the first in the series and it's with Cameron. It's diverse. It turns out both of us are trying to be sheep farmers without a farm. We talk about his PhD, guardian dogs, challenges, opportunities within the industry, culture and religion, and what this has to do with sheep markets. He's a sustainability director for American Land Board and has worked as a livestock extension educator and, of course, he's a farmer. Thank you so much for your time. We've navigated time differences here. I'm going to get straight into it. The hardest question, three words to describe yourself. What are they?
Oh, man, three things to describe myself. Hardworking, passionate, and family focused. And that last one probably needs to come first. But I'm fortunate to have a network that I'm immediately related to that allows me to do those first two things pretty intensively.
I love that. It's interesting. I reckon we're going to get hardworking a lot from this series because we're interviewing sheep farmers. Just done the first interview with a sheep farmer from Wales and she said the same thing. And I don't think you can be someone in this game without liking a bit of hard work.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That hardworking aspect, it's a given, but especially if you want to be successful, it has to go into the operation.
No, absolutely. Now, on to the next question and the most important, who are you? So tell us about you, where you're recording today, and then we'll lead into what it is you do.
Yeah. So I'm Dr. Cameron Meyerly. I'm based in Central Ohio. And in Central Ohio, I operate a sheep operation on a family farm that's been passed down through generations for a number of years. And most recently have ventured out with another family and we operate what's called New Slate Land Management. And that company is focused on targeted grazing and an avenue or an area of targeted grazing that is specific to solar grazing. So we are contract grazers providing a vegetation management service underneath solar panels so that we can try to marry agriculture and clean energy production here in the United States.
That's amazing. And did you always know you were going to be a sheep farmer?
Yeah, so that's a long question, you know, or a long answer if you have the time for it.
No, absolutely. It was something... That's what we're here for. I wouldn't
okay. Yeah. So if you want the history and the story on that, my parents moved back to the family farm about 24, 25 years ago. And my grandmother actually grew up raising Corridale sheep in Ohio on this family farm. And sheep were here before she was here. But the Corridale breed was something that she really got into. And we have a program in the United States and I don't believe it extends outside of America, and that's 4-H. And it's a youth livestock education program, not tied to school in any way. It's just an extracurricular that they do a lot more than just animal science. But that was the avenue that I was passionate about and she was passionate about. And so, back then, it's a very different time. And she always likes to remind me that she's one of the first female in that 4-H club to exhibit a livestock project as opposed to a sewing or a homemaking project. And so she likes to remind me that not only was she showing with the boys, but she was beating the boys a lot of the time as well. And so when we moved back to the family farm, there was You start out about age 9, 10 in that 4-H program, and she bought that first ewe lamb, and with a lot of individuals, we get started in 4-H and find a passion for livestock. It's a phenomenal program that teaches responsibility and assists with showing people where their food comes from and the work that goes into producing a quality product. And so through that program, developed a set of breeding ewes and learned a lot. You know, those are not the same sheep that I have today, but really instilled a passion for animal science. And so, you know, throughout high school, I was kind of the outlier that, you know, agriculture wasn't necessarily the cool thing in the school that I grew up in. So you had a lot of questions, never really felt understood. A lot of questions like, oh, you want to be a vet? Like, no, I don't want to be a vet. Oh, you want to, you know, just be a farmer. And it's like, ideally, that would be awesome. But it's not in the cards. You know, I didn't inherit, you know, vast quantities of land or have the equipment that we could really jump into it. And a lot of upfront capital if you want to be a full-time farmer in the U.S. And so, and I think that's probably the case around the world. And it's not getting any cheaper. So that passion really stemmed from 4-H, and then knew I wanted to pursue education at the college level, at the university level. And so our land grant university here in Ohio, the Ohio State University, sought out to do a 2-year degree, just an associate's degree in a science field. And that was livestock sciences. And that internship, kind of the pivoting point in my higher education career, was I had an internship taking care of sows. So a large scale hog operation. And the reason I was in that field was we had a lot of hog farms in Ohio. We still do throughout the Midwest, because we raise a lot of grain, raise a lot of corn and soybeans. And so it fits. And I remember sitting on one side of the table as an intern, and the company individuals from a well-known genetics company were sitting on the other side of the table, and they were asking questions. And those that had worked in that facility for, you know, 5, 10 years couldn't come up with the answers. But here I am with, you know, a year of college education under my belt and knew every single answer. Now I'm the intern. I'm not going to answer the question, but it was kind of at that point in time that I said, if I'm going to do this, I want to sit on the other side of the table. And I can't do that with the education track that I'm on right now. And so pursued a 4-year degree, a bachelor's of science in animal science, and really fell in love with the idea of university extension. And again, not sure if it exists outside of the U.S., but that extension service is stemming out of that land grant university. And it's producer education specific to agriculture is where it originated. A lot of other programs around that extension focus now, but knew I wanted to be involved in the producer education through that university extension program. And at the time, it wasn't initially required, but it was suggested that you have a graduate level degree. And so it wasn't until my senior year in college that I realized that you could pursue a master's degree in something specific like sheep and sheep production. And so that actually led down to West Virginia University, where pursued and completed both a master's degree and a PhD in animal science. And that's probably the boring stuff and maybe a separate episode, but yeah, animal science, joined the parasite immunology lab. So studied all things parasites and looked pretty intensively at terminal sire modeling for commercial sheep operations, along with my PhD project really focused on the nutritional impact of Homonchus contortus, our barber pole worm, and just what that metabolism is doing and the impact on nutrition. So that was all the background. And then if we fast forward through that to today, I spent a short time in that extension role at Penn State University, where I was able to cut my teeth on producer education and was very fortunate to have that opportunity. And then today, I'm the sustainability director for the American Land Board, and that's my day job. And we're still pursuing the sheep production side of things very intensively. But yeah, I still get to educate producers. We just got off a road trip, finished our second workshop. It's a nationwide series on targeted grazing. And so trying to figure out how we can grow the U.S. sheep industry and get producers the education to assist them in that growth. So that was a lot, but that's the quick story of how we got here and what we're doing right now.
So I have lots of questions within that, but I want to go right back to the start to your grandmother. So yeah. Is she still on the farm now, or who's on your farm now within your family?
Yep. So she is, we're fortunate she's still around and it still helps out. You know, she was in the early days, you know, we're forking out barns together and she was running a wheelbarrow, and we still laugh today, like, oh man, I don't know. You know, she'll tell me, I don't know if you were still using a wheelbarrow, if I could still help you out. But you know, she waters sheep and has really stepped up. We got two small girls, and so technically there's four generations living on the family farm right now, which is cool when you stop and think about it. But yeah, that generation's still around. My mother and father still live on the farm, and you know, dad gets a lot of credit. The sheep have always been kind of my area of interest, and you know, he is bought in 100%, and we're pursuing that again very, very intensively. But while I was at grad school and in college, you know, he was the main man to get stuff done and make sure everything was taken care of.
I'm on an intergenerational farm as well, so there's four generations on our place still. My grandparents
very cool.
are there, and I think sometimes I forget how lucky we are to have that. Like, it's not normal. You know, I grew up with my grandparents 100 meters down the road, and now my nephew's growing up with the same. So it's interesting. But I should have started with this question, really. But what kind of sheep do you have?
Yeah, so every type and kind from start to finish. Right now, we're operating, the majority are Katahdin hare sheep. So a breed that originated in the U.S. and it's a composite developed in the state of Maine. And I discovered those in grad school down there at West Virginia University. We were doing a lot of research with those sheep specific to the parasite resistance side of things, and really just fell in love with the breed there. You know, we were looking at some terminal sire projects, some differences in those sheep, and those sheep were coming out of the southeastern United States, where we have a lot of fescue, a lot of parasite, internal parasite pressure, and yeah. Those sheep were doing a very, very good job out on forage, and then for that first year of projects, we're doing those lambs coming off of that tall fescue were doing very well in the feedlot as well. And so at the time, you know, had an opportunity to invest in some of those Katahdin genetics, just commercial use. And again, when I was essentially farming remotely and having other people deal with a lot of stuff at home, that breed really fit what we needed for the time. And so now, again, we fast forward to today, mostly Katahdin ewes. We have some Dorset ewes, and then we're breeding our own terminal sires, and those are predominantly Texel sheep.
Yeah. And I'm interested, you mentioned before, so how you work with another family. So that's how you're navigating like your business model at the moment with the grazing under the solar panels. How did you go about that? Because I think, as you mentioned, it is hard to get into farming. It is really, really hard to expand. It's almost impossible now. basically, if you're starting from scratch. So we do, I think collaboration and thinking outside the square is becoming all the more important if you want to be a farmer. You don't just get a bunch of land now, or you don't, or navigating ways to go about it if you aren't necessarily born into a sheep station. So how did you find that opportunity? Because that's really interesting. And how did you navigate that business partnership?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's still pretty fresh. So we're only 2 years into the new slate land management model. And part of that is demand. So solar grazing has existed here in the US for 10, 12 years. I'm not going to say tops, but we're really starting to see some traction and some real movement and demand for sheep under these photovoltaic arrays. And so I remember 2 years ago, Brad Carruthers and his wife, Katie, Brad and I were on our way down to a workshop that we were hosting through a regional Katahdin club. And there was a field day in North Carolina, and we were talking about Central Ohio is just booming with what I consider a modern day industrial revolution. So, we're seeing companies like Intel, Amazon, Meta, Microsoft popping up, whether it's data centers or chip factories, And so with that comes demand for power, demand for electricity, and we're seeing just the expansion of that industry coming to, the state that I've grown up in. And we're talking about had mutual friend that was grazing solar, and we had seen it and heard it before. And actually, while we were down in North Carolina, visited a site that was being grazed by sheep. And I remember driving down, Brad's talking about it. I had previously been thinking about it just with the boom of industry, saying, this is something that we're trying to grow. I cannot compete with cash rent value of row crop ground. It's not going to happen. We have very high quality soils, and just those soils are very competitive to lease. And we kind of came to a point where it was, well, this is neat. You're going to pursue it. Oh, this is cool. I'm going to pursue it. We can either do it separately and, talk about it once a year, twice a year, or we could do it together and really put our resources together and our sheep together and pursue this at a high level. And that's ultimately what we came to the decision on. And so from June of 22 to that fall, had a new name, had an operating agreement, and just this past winter, so lambing in 23, all of the sheep were combined and have some very lofty goals of expansion. We have our first big site. We were on a community scale site previously, which was awesome. In community scale, we were talking smaller acreage, smaller footprint. We have also what's called utility scale. And so utility scale is 100 acres plus of solar panels. So we've got a contract for next couple of years to get us started on 1600 acres. So 1300 acres under panels, 300 acres ancillary, and that number is hopefully going to increase. But we went from what the home farm footprint that could be 200 acres, and some of that is still in row crop agriculture, and maybe running 8 to 1,000 head of sheep, to 1300 acres where we could be running 3 to 5,000 sheep as a company. And so we're excited for it. And we're not the first ones to do this. There have been a lot of other people that have gone down this avenue, and fortunate to know a lot of those people and learn from both their positives and negatives that they've come across. But, it's one of those things, there has been far more upside than negative. So we were weaning lambs 2 weeks ago, and we just sat there and kind of chuckled because it's like we should have been doing this 4 years ago. They were only 30 minutes north of where we lived. We were in the commercial flock. I was grabbing rams from that they were buying, using. I'd bring them down, use them in my flock. So the genetics, honestly, have been very similar. And, Brad's an engineer. I come to the table with the animal science background. And so, when we get to meet with a solar company, we kind of have all of our bases covered. And so that's a fun situation to be in. Seen a lot of other people doing it as individuals, and there's nothing wrong with that. I just don't know how I would manage my day job, the shepherding duties, trying to get contracts, and all of the things that come with that. So it is there's certainly some growing pains when you lose a sheep and it doesn't have your ear tag in it. You feel a little, maybe a little bit greater guilt associated with that. And ultimately, just open lines of communication and talking about what the future holds and what do we need to do right now so that everybody's on the same page.
And how, like, logistic wise, is the fencing good around these solar panels? And do you just have like big water trucks where you sort of shift them around, or like what facilities are there?
Yeah, great question. So, like, you're ready to navigate your own contract because those two things are the first two bullet points that we like to talk about when dealing with the solar company. Because you have to remember that group most likely doesn't have anybody on staff that comes from agriculture, let alone a sheep background. And so we need two things: good fence and water. And we probably need water more than we need good fence. And so a lot of what we're seeing now is the early installations of fencing that went around these. It's federal mandate to have fencing around these solar sites because at the end of the day, it is a power plant. They're generating a significant amount of power to go and be used by consumers. There is a fence around it. Early installations were mostly chain link. Now we're seeing more of an ag style fencing. It's still, 6 foot plus tall. And, gates, if gates aren't installed correctly, we might have a foot gap. And so a lot of it's going around and just being careful to look and see here's a dip in the ground that, the fencing company isn't going to fix. And so as the grazer, you fix that and make the improvements to that fence so that, we protect those livestock. Ultimately, very few are running sheep in these sites without livestock guardian dogs because there is always the threat of predation. Yeah, it's one of the biggest things we deal with here in the US. And so those guardian dogs are becoming less of a luxury and more of a requirement. And so
What breed of guardian dogs the most
all types and kinds, yeah, and they come from all over the place. So in the early stages, you saw a lot of Great Pyrenees, a lot of long-haired type dogs. We've got an Akbash, see a lot of Anatolian Shepherds, some Kangals, I believe a Turkish breed. But like anymore, if somebody says, "Oh, I've got such and such," it's like, okay, like it's not surprising because we're bringing them in and breeding them. And honestly, had a gentleman talk to me one time when I was in that extension role, and his comment was best dogs he has are the crossbreds. And so it's very much what we see in our sheep as well, that hybrid vigor, that heterosis that we see in our livestock species carries over in other animal breeding schemes. And so a lot of times you'll see any different type of crossbred that of those breeds that were just mentioned.
And how do
And
you go, like, how often are you guys having to check them? Because and this in my brain started off as not labor intensive. You've just got them out there grazing, similar to a station here in Australia. But now I'm like, okay, now you've got guard dogs. And I'm like, oh, there is predators. Like, how can you actually go about day to day? And are you running ewes and lambs through in this end, like this part of your enterprise, or is this just like finishing off sheep?
Yeah, so great questions. There's all types of models that are being pursued through this. A lot of it has to do with distance from that home site. And so, yeah, I've got a lot of people I've worked with where they might be grazing a solar site that's 4 or 5 hours from the home farm. They make it out twice a week and they check their other two sites on the way and that's their full-time job. You know, that's how they're pursuing that. And we, in those situations, we have a continuous supply of water. You know, it tends to be on a float, and some remote devices like camera on that water trough to make sure, you know, animals are where they're supposed to be and water troughs stay full in that float system. Back to the water discussion, that's one of the things when we're working with solar sites or solar companies, if they want to pursue grazing or at least have a site that's conducive to grazing and want to capture all of the benefits of having sheep under those panels, water on that site is a huge, huge hurdle to get over. If I don't have to haul water, the price that I can charge you for vegetation management drastically reduces. And so we're seeing companies now that are adopting a grazing friendly site design. And so they're putting water in, not only in one location, but multiple locations, and having a plan for what their post-construction vegetation planting looks like. It's a beneficial vegetation species, forage mix for grazing. So yeah, it's a lot of it's subjective to your later questions. You know, ideally, if I was right next door, I'm going out and checking every day. Would I need to? No. Those guard dogs are out there doing their job. We have some free choice feeder setups for those dogs, and yeah, those remote monitoring devices to assist us with checking on those animals and making sure water is always present for those sheep. So at the end of the day, you know, we're trying to provide a service. We're removing vegetation, which fire suppression and shading of that panel, that's ultimately why we're there. And we're there with sheep, or they're going to do it with a mower. And then secondly, you know, we're trying to do something that's an improvement to that soil underneath that panel, that solar panel. We're trying to keep that ground, which was most of the time agricultural ground, and keep it in a food producing acre. And that's something that I get pretty passionate about. But yeah, it's, we're trying to do a good job and not ruin it for those that are wanting to pursue it, and to not ruin it for, you know, my kids who are the next generation of hopefully sheep producers.
I'll have to get the link off you for the feeder setup you use for your dogs, because they're only sort of becoming, just like over the last few years, becoming a thing here where I'm from in Western Australia, particularly in pasture rotation, like with chooks. Pasture-raised chooks in caravans, which is becoming more common. Huge problem is the feeding of the dogs. It's something in all of my groups that I'm in. We're like, oh, everyone's sharing feeder designs and setups to not have to go out there every day to feed the dogs, with, because they're finding the chooks or the birds are stealing them. But with some of the challenges there, so you've mentioned predators. So what predators are you guys up against?
Yeah, so a lot of coyote. Predation here in the eastern United States, a lot of wild dog predation. Honestly, the wild dogs are, and when I say wild dogs, those are like domestic dogs. Yeah. So dogs that somebody has just let loose and now they're strays, and those will run in packs. I'd say that those two, the wild dogs, those stray dogs, are probably more of an issue because they don't kill to eat. They kill for fun. And so just heard a story recently. You know, someone had worked their sheep up, and you know, another solar grazer had them in a paddock. They had taken one semi out and were coming back to get the next batch. While they were gone, pack of wild dogs came in, killed 42 in a matter of like 6 hours. And the only reason they killed 42 is because the first one stopped playing with them when they killed it. Like that's gruesome, but that is reality. And it's hard to deal with. You know, out in the western regions, we're seeing, you know, wolf pressure, some mountain lion pressure, and those are more protected species. So what do you do when you can't shoot the thing? You know, what can you do? And even, you know, I can put a dog in, or a donkey, or a llama, and do a pretty good job against a lot of wild dog and a lot of coyote pressure in this part of the country. I mean, my donkey's as good as dinner in those western regions where we have wolf pressure or bear pressure. I mean, you need an offensive attack, something that can fight back in those scenarios. And there's still individuals that are losing guard dogs to, a pack of wolves. And it makes sense, and it's very frustrating. But the stories, I don't tell any predator stories because anything I have doesn't hold a candle to the stories I've heard from people out west where they're fortunate to have made it out with their life. So
Oh, it's just so many areas. I think I always associate it with cattle production over there because of that predator pressure. So it's really cool to hear about, I suppose, sheep. And that, like, my next question is the sheep industry, well, in your neck of the woods, but throughout the US, how, I think we underestimate how big it is the rest of the world because we all watch Yellowstone and we just see cows. And
I
usually
mean,
sheep farmers get forgotten about.
that is the truth. I have a lot of respect for our cattle ranchers and farmers across the US, and it is, we think about what America does well. We have a lot of problems, but one of the things that I think we should be more proud about is the quantity and quality of food that we're producing, both on the animal side and on the grain side of things. And so, the cattle production side of things is huge. And the sheep are, we sit in the back seat from an animal number standpoint, and we're okay with it. Would we love to have comparable numbers of, mature ewe flock? Of course we would. But it comes with a lot of hurdles. One of the issues we just talked about, predation. We do not see predation to the same extent in our cattle as we do in our small ruminant species, specifically sheep. We don't see predation in a lot of our swine production because we've moved them inside. And so, if we look at swine and poultry production, we have taken out a lot of the issues, a lot of the environmental pressures on those two industries because we've put them in a human environment, and it's still a livestock environment created by humans to minimize those environmental impacts. So, there are plenty of producers, sheep producers, that have taken that approach. We go to kind of the Midwest. It's all over the US, but specifically in the Midwest, we talk about Iowa, further west of where I'm at. And the productivity of that ground is exceptional. I mean, they can grow a lot of commodity, any commodity, in large quantity. And so to put sheep out on grass in that part of the country is, some would say, foolish, because it's not utilizing your resources to the greatest of their ability. And so you're moving those sheep inside, some pretty fancy setups with confinement operations, and delivering what that ewe needs every day of her life, exactly when she needs it and what she needs, and pulling all of the internal parasite issues out, or most of the internal parasite issues out, all of the predation out. We can raise sheep with pretty minimal death loss, pretty minimal mortality in those environments, as long as our stewardship and management follow suit with how we're raising those animals.
Do you have issues? I was speaking to a farmer yesterday in Wales, and they lamb in barns in Wales. And I know here in Australia we've got same as where you are, like feedlots, but we also have live exports, so it's like a feedlot on the sea. And a huge social license issues. People always ask, why are they not in paddocks? And is that an issue over there? Are you seeing, social license? And people just are becoming more curious as to how their food is produced, which is an incredible thing. But with that is coming a lot of questions. Is that a problem for you guys?
And I don't know if it's as much of a problem as just being able to tell the story. And I think it's neat that people are actually interested in knowing where their food comes from and how it was raised. It's another thing to understand just because you feel that it's not correct as a consumer, but you've never done it or aren't really interested in why it's being done, that's a whole different story that both consumers and producers need to get better at asking and understanding, and then telling and being willing to tell in a fashion that is positive. Again, we go back to cost of what that protein is. We look at the poultry industry, and I'm not saying it's perfect or I'm a fan of it or any, I'm just trying to stay unbiased. People enjoy going to their grocery store or their supermarket and purchasing chicken at an affordable price. And as we start to change how that animal is raised because of ethical concern or I don't like the way it sounds, and that price goes up, are we willing to pay more for that item? And so we see diversification of our marketing, and those that maybe have that extra income to spend on a product that's been raised in the fashion that they would prefer. So we have a lot of, especially on the egg side of things, like cage free, free range, there's 20 different things in the grocery store. My issue is on the consumer side, I don't know what any of it means. And so it might sound good, but is it truly what I want it to be? Telling that story is always upfront or on the front of our minds. And again, in agriculture, we have gotten by without needing to have that conversation with the public. The public now is so far removed from agriculture in this country, and we could argue the world, that the need to tell that story and be advocates or advocates of what we're doing on a daily basis has never been more important than it is right now.
Absolutely. I think we're on the cusp of a really important food trend. I think, as you know, we've gone through like paleo, where that was a huge trend. And now the trend is knowing where your food comes from. People want to feel good about themselves and want to feel like they're doing the right thing. So they're starting to ask the questions. But then at the same time, we've got whole countries who can't produce enough food to feed their people. And it's literally getting shipped and flown from another country across. So there is a huge divide, isn't there? It's interesting. So would you say that's one of the biggest challenges for you guys over there as an industry?
Yeah, as a sheep industry, our biggest problem is supply and demand.
Yeah.
For what you just said. And this is, it depends on which sheep producer you talk to, how they feel about Australian lamb or New Zealand lamb. Because right now, we're importing 70% of the lamb that's consumed in the U.S. is coming from Australia and New Zealand. So no offense, I don't love that number. I don't love that number because we should be able to raise more of that product. Where I sit on that fence is we have demand for lamb. And if something happened and we just said, yep, we're not importing any more lamb, it's only going to be a U.S. product. Well, then we have consumers. We can't supply it all right now, obviously. We have consumers that then don't see it on a shelf. And so what happens in 15, 20 years when we can grow to the point where we can supply all of that and they haven't seen it for 15 or 20 years? Like it doesn't work that way. And so that import-export situation, it can be contentious depending on who you talk to.
Oh, absolutely. And
ultimately,
pork, like in Australia, we have like an incredible pork industry, but like we ship in so much pork and it's put on the shelf amongst the Australian pork.
Yeah.
And
like, oh, where does it come from?
Like it's crazy. And well, it's funny you say that, no offense, but I look at US lamb. And I've not been over there myself, but I look at some of the stats and where you're sending it to, I'm like, oh, that should be us.
right. And that's, and it's just a fact of life. And, one of the issues we have as U.S. producers, very diverse in our production models. So, and very diverse in our consumer demands. So we have a traditional market, we have a non-traditional market. That traditional market tends to be larger animals, so 140 to 160 pound slaughter lambs. Those tend to be out of, white face ewes and a lot of times terminal sires. When I think of the traditional terminal lamb coming out of the Western United States for retail, for restaurant trade, we're looking at a Rambouillet, more of a fine wool range type ewe, and a Suffolk on the sire side. Those sheep are going to be lean. They're going to grow exceptionally well, and they're going to finish it at 150 pounds. Over here in the east, and you have to think too, that area is terrain. Those sheep have to move. So we start to talk about frame size. It matters when you've got to travel some distance to, take a bite here and then move, and take a bite there and then move. Those calories that are being spent to move is, for locomotion is different than here in the east, where, I move sheep every couple of days to a 2 acre paddock. We graze it off and we let it rest for 60 days, and then I'll come back and graze it two more times in the year. My sheep don't need to travel on hoof. So, most of my ewes are less than 140 pounds. I've got to really work if I want to get a lamb to 140, 150 pounds. And so I also don't have demand for that. Some people would say, well, why don't you raise 200 pound ewes? Then you could do it. And I'd say, you're exactly right. The issue is I don't have a product, or the demand for my product is not the same. And so my product tends to be a lightweight, what we consider a non-traditional or ethnic product. And they're leaving usually right off of mom at about 60 pounds. If we wait a couple weeks, depending on what ethnic holiday is around, maybe we can get them to 70, 75 pounds, and we're cashing in on a premium for those ethnic holidays. If I'm only raising 60, 75 pound lambs, why do I need 200 pound ewes? That 200 pound ewe has a metabolic requirement for maintenance. At 200 pounds, very different metabolic requirement at 140 pounds. And so I can raise more 140 pound ewes than I can 200 pound ewes in my environment. And so that's really what we've been pursuing. And so that's, again, getting into the weeds on just diversity in our sheep population. That's not the only, if that was the only diversity, we could overcome a lot of challenges. It gets expansive very quickly.
You say you're supplying like ethnic, very niche market, and for a premium. So, how much are you getting paid for that lamb? And by ethnic holiday, what are you referring to?
Yeah, so we probably considered it a niche market 20 years ago, and it has dominated the, I'd say, East Coast production model. I mean, it's all over the place now. It is not just our coastal cities that demand this. When we think about the United States as a whole and consider it a melting pot, so a landing area for all types of people and cultures. And the fun thing about when you land here with a different culture, your culture tends to follow. And so, maybe we Americanize it over a couple of generations, not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. But we see populations of individuals that consumed land or lamb in their homeland and want to continue to consume lamb. For example, Greek Orthodox Easter is a very big holiday for us across the US. They want lightweight lambs with carcasses no larger than 40 pounds. To do that, we're talking sheep less than 80 pounds live weight. Other ethnic holidays, the end of of Ramadan, an Islamic holiday that we consume a lot of lamb in that time period. It used to be, Christian Easter or Western Easter, whatever you want to call it, was like this pinnacle of American lamb consumption. I'm of the opinion, and I don't have stats to back this up, that that is probably dwindling. We used to be, you had a leg of lamb during then, maybe Christmas. We're really in that area of ethnic slaughter and ethnic demand working around their holiday and their calendar. And so you'll see entire production models that breed sheep around that Islamic holiday calendar. And it works for a lot of people. I know, we were lambing in a barn, in a shed in January so that we could move lambs in March. When you asked, what are you getting for these sheep? Just an arbitrary number, we sent a trailer load of lambs in that March setting. And so we had two things working for us there: low supply during that time of year, because not everybody's lambing in January, December, because we have winter and it's cold. It's not a lot of fun to lamb sheep out when it's, 15, negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit out. And so, you do that for these premiums. And so I know that year, probably the highest we'd ever sold lambs for, and we were getting right around 430 a pound live weight. And those were 70-pound lambs. So, we were up over, $250 to $300 per head. And you have to remember, this is coming straight off the ewe. So I have maybe 75 days. That lamb is 75 days old. That ewe is dry, and I can put her out on grass. Her nutrient demands are way lower than what they are during lactation, late gestation. And so I can, in that model, I can raise more sheep on the grass that I have, because that maintenance, feeding during maintenance, is very different than feeding during lactation. So again, that's an arbitrary number of just prices per pound that we've seen. Now, anything from that 250 to four, we have ranges on quality of animal. In our part of the world, those butterball, what we call hothouse lambs, tend to be Dorset influenced. So they look round and they look plump at, 60 to 70 pounds and have some shapeliness to them. Those sheep will bring a premium at public auction every week, and especially in January through April, when we have again lower supply, high demand, and then those holidays coming at the tail end of winter, early spring.
And so you say public auction. And so does that mean literally anyone can buy a sheep from the public auction and then slaughter it at home? You're allowed to home slaughter? In
That's a
Australia,
good
you're only allowed to kill for yourself. Like, so our family, we slaughter our own animals, but we're not allowed to slaughter our animals and feed anybody else. It's really strict, like the regulations around that.
Yes. So that is also how it works in the US. And so those lambs are leaving, and I'm sure if anybody from the, I mean, anywhere in the US, they'll say, "Oh, well, we've killed 100 out here for other people." It's like, great, that's fine until the USDA finds you and then slaps you with something. So, yes, you can slaughter for personal use. Most of those lambs are being purchased by order buyers. And then where we're at in Ohio, it's a pretty reasonable drive, 6 hours, 7 hours over to New York City. It's probably 5, 6 hours up to Detroit. And so we have these cultural hubs around these cities, and these lambs will go into those areas and be slaughtered, and then from there go out through their respective channels to end up on somebody's dinner table. during those holidays and really throughout the year. And so one of the fun things, I'll touch on it here briefly, you were talking about this Americanized culture. You'll get these, I don't know if you'd call them old order, Muslims that really want to be there for the halal slaughter process and want to take the hide off, take the organs, any of that awful that they can get. And again, that cultural instinct or demand that they have, it's what they came from, that's what they know. A really cool story came out of Detroit. The grandfather started buying from this meat shop, wanted to be there, wanted to be present and get all of the stuff. The next generation, his son, he was there, wasn't as important to take the offal. And now the grandson comes in and he wants a stack of lamb chops, the bratwurst, the value added product, still wants to eat lamb, but he wants these premium cuts, doesn't need the offal, doesn't need to be there for the slaughter. And so it's again, like that's very much the American consumer, and we're seeing it impact culture. Again, as long as they're still eating lamb, like I don't have a problem with it, but just some of those interesting just takeaways on how those buying habits change, I think are very interesting.
No, I definitely think we underestimate how much like values within a family. And I say people always associate culture with religion, but I think it's almost like two different things. So Australia supplies Indonesia with a lot of live export beef, and really similar, they love their wet markets. And people are like, oh, we do it because of religion or because of lack of refrigeration. But there's actually like these cultural practices associated with the ability to see you. They want to use that entire animal. They're not westernized. They don't want to waste a single part of that animal. They want to be there. They want to barter for it. They want that, what they've always done. And in the Middle East, it's very similar. Like they've set up like an agreement we have in place with the Middle East is when we supply them with animals, the exporters have to oversee the welfare of the animal. We're unique compared to other countries until they're slaughtered. So they've come to an agreement where there's platforms and, massive windows because they're all still there. They want to see that animal being slaughtered. They pick it, they follow it along the platform. Kids go to the abattoirs. There's a playground at the abattoir because it's still, and it's a religious thing, but it's also a cultural thing. Like they want all that, they'll be there saying what they want bagged up. And I think we're so westernized in so many ways. We've got a lot to learn from these other countries and cultures as to particularly around
Yeah.
food
No,
wastage.
that's a great point because again, you probably have some of that older generation sees the kids over on the playground and they're like, oh, back in my day, didn't have a playground and I would have had to have been at this window if my dad was here and all of this stuff. But no, that's a great point. It's not specific to religion. It
No.
is that cultural demand and the bartering aspect that you brought up. That is huge. And so when we talk to a lot of on-farm purchasing of these lambs, so I had an older gentleman that does a lot of this. So they come out of Pittsburgh, they know he's in a network of people, and they know that you call him up, you come out, he has a pen of sheep. What you said, they want to pick it out. They want to see it and be the one responsible for selecting it. And his comment was, he said, I always start $100 higher because they have to feel. I said, but yeah, but you're asking for, way more than what it's worth. He said, doesn't matter. They just want to feel like they brought me down from a price. And like he's still getting a premium, but you go into it knowing, he's got it figured out because he has a long-standing relationship with these people. And again, has sold to grandfathers, fathers, and now this third generation. And those are neat stories to hear about.
Yeah, I find it really ironic. We talk about like how religion influences changing, particularly Middle East or even Indonesia, or in the Middle East population's grown, so there's more of a demand for box meat rather than like live animals. It's still there and it will always be there, but it's more, it's not the 20-year-old isn't gonna go. They're like, oh, I'm happy to go to the supermarket and then just go during Eid or whatever. But then here we are in like, well, in Australia and the Western world, we're trying to like revert back to going out and picking our strawberries. You know, they're like, oh yeah, bring the supermarkets in, that's all good. And then we're like, no, like we want to go back to picking the berries and going to the farmers markets. Like, it's just such an interesting juxtaposition. Yeah, we're like, oh, the Western culture is in some cases, I think, unfortunately, very influential, but in not always good. They have this incredible connection to where their food comes from that we're trying to rediscover here in Western countries. Now, you talked about lambing in barns. So, what's your lambing percentages if you're there, and what's some issues that you have, or lamb mortality issues? Because ours are out in the paddock, similar, well, I suppose similar to you guys normally, like depending on the time of the year. So, like, do you see an improvement in lambing percentages when you're lambing in barns?
So that model I'd mentioned earlier, like in the Midwest, so in Iowa, it's not uncommon to see lambing percentages in the 220s. And so, I mean, it's pretty high. I know with the sheep that we have here, the best we've been able to do, and this was to weaning, was 195. It was a drop percentage of 210, and and so lost 15%, whether it was from stillborns or and what often happens is that that triplet, while she's cleaning off the first two, doesn't make it out quite in time. Or you might think this is crazy, but we were lambing in January. I've got cameras set up that link right up to my phone, and so instead of going out and checking that barn, I'm hopping on an app on my phone and looking at those sheep. And we still do that with the nucleus flock. So the commercial flock lambs out on pasture will lamb out under solar panel, which I'd argue still provides a degree of shelter in that grassland environment. Just another one of the added benefits. But the nucleus flock, I don't want to face the challenge of having to go out and source genetics that are going to work for our operation. And so we've made the commitment, and both those flocks now combined were seed stock flocks to begin with. And so working through the National Sheep Improvement Program, selecting sheep for on paper for estimated breeding values, like what we do in cattle, quite often with EPDs. And so I know you guys in Australia use EBVs probably more regularly than what we do here in the US, but it's something we're very committed to. And so that nucleus flock still lambs in a barn because I'd like to know how that individual is performing, how that dam is raising those lambs, and if there are any concerns that I can spot now, because the goal is she's producing a ram to go out and breed my commercial flock. And so that generation has to be able to work in a hands-off extensive environment. And so, it 190 to 210 is kind of where we're shooting for. That's in February. We can probably stay closer to that 210 if we lamb in March, which would be our seasonal lambing time of year. And out on pasture, I'd expect with mortality, I'd really like to lamb and wean, 175 to 160. For me personally, I need to be over that 150 mark, just for what our growth plans are. And if my mature ewes are dropping 180, my ewe lambs, my yearling ewes can drop, 130, and we can still be over that 150 mark.
And this is, I'm backtracking a teeny tiny bit. We're talking about paddocks and walking distances earlier. How big are your paddocks on average? Or, and not just yours, but in your area, like how big a
Just in
property?
general, we see a lot of continuous grazing. So, we'll just put a perimeter fence and people send sheep out to graze and let them find the grass. We're pretty intensive on the rotational grazing side of things, not as intensive as what some are, but we're moving every 2 to 3 days, and those moves are going into 2 to 3 acre paddock sizes, depending on it really depends on forage height, forage mass and quality. So if I've got, I guess the other aspect is just class of production, where that ewe's at. You know, if we're in lactation, which the ewes are in lactation now, we won't spend as long in that paddock because I want them to eat that more palatable, which we're hoping is more nutrient dense, and leave what they don't have to eat behind. Those open ewes, we're doing a lot in that solar environment, especially trying to control some noxious weeds that maybe aren't their first pick, but they will clean them up if we force them to. And then, so a lot of temporary fence, that's what a lot of the labor is in these tardive grazing applications, setting that temporary fence up and then moving those sheep into those different allotments. So I would say on average, though, that's a great question. It depends on the size of your operation. On average, I don't think many or most are practicing a rotational grazing system. And that is a different episode on why we do that. But yeah, again, it's something we're passionate about.
Yeah. So of course, yeah, your paddock size would be different to others. So in regards to your ewes, and so lambing in the barns and observation, do you use EID tags over there? Or electronic, I don't know actually what you're
talking about. Yeah. So yeah. Very familiar with them. Use them quite a bit in the research setting. A lot of my work, especially for the PhD, was in a grow safe system, and so monitoring daily intake. And so to use that system, have to use an electronic ID tag, because that's the only way, you know, nobody's sitting there with a pen and paper 24 hours a day writing down who the ewe is and how much she ate. So it's something that we're moving towards. It's not a requirement as of now, and I don't necessarily see the benefit of it until we start implementing the improved management practices with it. So if I have a Bluetooth scale head, for example, where I can just wand the tag, everything links up, it pulls the weight, and I move the lamb through. We're seeing, really in the last couple of years, a lot of technology coming mostly from overseas. And my mentor that was, it is still there at West Virginia University, is a rep for Tapari. And so, you know, he's moving a lot of those handler systems across the U.S., especially here in the Eastern United States. I would love to have one. You know, sticker price, a little hesitant, but I've seen the thing work, and I know it is a labor savings. And that's one of our biggest challenges is sourcing, as we expand, sourcing labor and good labor. Mm. You know, our border collie is probably the best employee we have. And that probably includes myself. So, you know, he gets up and he's excited to work sheep every day.
Yeah.
I cannot say the same for myself.
Yeah,
and it depends. Yeah, he doesn't care if it's raining or snowing or anything. He just wants to get out and work.
Around the panels, though, the solar panels, it'd be easier to send a dog than a human because they're a bit more agile to get it everywhere, whereas, like, you'd have to crawl on this, surely.
Well, and that's, you know, you can't see me just from, you know, the chest up today, but I'm pretty tall.
Yeah.
I'm not short. And so, you know, the picture I have behind me, I have to walk around these rows.
Yeah.
I can't, unless I get on all fours and crawl underneath, I can't get under them except for like at 12 o'clock when these are tracking panels. And so they follow the sun at 12 o'clock, they lay flat. So I can walk underneath them then. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the dog is an absolute necessity for us in this environment, an absolute necessity for me here on the home farm. And it might sound like I've had a dog for 20 years, but I've had one for 6 months, and I don't know how I did it before then. So
did you buy trained dog, or did you buy a pup?
I did. Yeah. So I bought a retired trial dog.
Yeah.
And from a really great family, really great trainer here in Ohio. And, you know, I believe their daughter actually went overseas for like the world's, you know, challenge. So like they're very much into the trialing side of things. And, you know, early on, my comment to my business partners now was, They've brought dogs over from Scotland, have significant investment in those dogs, and they're very, very high quality animals. My comment was, I'll just give me a dog and go out, get sheep, bring it back. I don't need all the bells and whistles. Now I have a dog with all the bells and whistles. He's 10 years old. So, and I was told when I got him, they're like, well, he used to run 31 miles an hour. He can only get up to about 26, 27 now. And I said, and this was like a negative. I said, well, I can run about 6. So, anything that's above that, well, it's fine by me. So I have a dog with all the bells and whistles now. I'm still learning and will always want a dog with the bells and whistles because I can find a use for those bells and whistles.
Now, what challenges for the future? What are you predicting for the industry overall? This is a big question to end on. And what's your goals 5 years and 10 years to get rid of Australian sheep out of Australian lamb out of America?
Yeah, like I said, I'm not wishing it out of here right now because we desperately need it. It's exciting to me, my short professional career to have seen the national consumption increase, from whatever I don't remember what it was to now about a pound, maybe a little over a pound, and that's per year, which is crazy. I eat way more than that, but I think once we get people trying more lamb and having positive eating experiences, that's our biggest hurdle right now is putting our product, and I'll say just lamb in general, getting that product in front of the consumer. And when I say in front of, not in the retail case, but in a consumable form, because I think once they try it, they realize I was intimidated by this before, but if I can do this, make this same dish or have a positive eating experience with something that I created, or maybe I go to my favorite restaurant and have a professional create it, that generates just consumer demand and a repeat buyer. And I think that's one of the things I hope that we see lamb in more than just a holiday dish, that we see it in an everyday consumption. And so, and maybe not every day, but those days between holidays, can we get it into, a burger or a taco or, something that is palatable, we enjoy eating, and it spices it up, it spruces that dish up. And we know that we're consuming a healthy red meat. So that's, I think, one of the biggest demands. There's so much that we are up against in terms of it, for me specifically, in this part of the world, it is land access. So if I can only raise so many sheep because of my access to acreage, I'm trying to find a way around that. And I believe we have. And the cool thing is, we're contributing to a big picture of improved soil ecology, improved public perception of these solar sites. It's been very positive, the discussions that I've had with, again, those energy companies that aren't from agriculture, but see the hard work and the dedication that's going into it, and saying, "Wow, like you're a cool partner to work with." The industry is a cool partner to work with. And again, I'm passionate about it. I think it can and should be a symbiotic relationship where both parties benefit and we grow together. It's just such a cool story. And so that's that for me. When you ask that 5-year plan, there's some big sites. I threw that 1300 acre site. That's our first big utility scale site. We have discussions on what we hope is a 5 to 10,000 acre portfolio, and that's multiple sites. When we think about what 5 to 10,000 acres would do, there's some big operations out west that are managing that size and scale. If I can run 3 ewes per acre, it's 30,000 sheep. I mean, that's a number when you ask Cameron, what, 15 years ago, what was your dream job? Like, oh, probably raising sheep full time. If I can't do it with 30,000 ewes, and my expectation is it's not just me. Like, I want to give that kid at age 15, 18, 20, who doesn't want to go overseas to raise sheep at large scale, or doesn't want to go out west, wants to live, 20 minutes from where they grew up and stay close to family, give them an opportunity to raise and have responsibility and be a part of something big and hopefully grow the US sheep industry. That to me is, it's a lofty goal. Those are big numbers. And when you sit there and talk to a solar developer and they have 2,000 acres under panel, and you say, well, that should be able to hold 6,000 ewes, and their jaw hits the floor. They're like, there's no way. It's like, my first internship, we were running 5,000 head of sows in one location. Agriculture is not foreign to scalability in large numbers, but we can't just run into it. And so, yeah, that 10-year plan, a lot of growth, a lot of education. I'm fortunate to have had the experiences that I've had to this point, and hoping to both provide those experiences to other people and provide education to other people along this journey.
No, that's incredible. And we talked about it briefly before we started recording your podcast. So for anyone like
Yes.
me who has just got a taste of what you do and wants to learn more, where can they listen?
Yeah, my plan was not to railroad this podcast with another podcast, but it's the Grazing Sheep Podcast, and it's hosted by Big Tom Perkins and myself, Cameron Meyerly. And this was something that, I take very little credit for origination of that podcast. So Tom, when I was in Extension in Pennsylvania, he met me there and called me about once a week at the office or on the cell phone, and we'd talk for an hour, sometimes longer than that. And he had an interest in doing a podcast and said, yeah, I think we should do it. Said, hey, I'm not the sound guy, you're the sound guy, but I will hop on and interview and just talk sheep with you. And so, yeah, we're a year and 3 months in,
Incredible.
and have a bunch of listens, have way more. We have about 1,000, 1,200 people listen a week, and it's exciting. So, yeah, if anybody wants to listen and hear more about, I'll say specific to the Eastern Midwest and Eastern United States sheep production, and a couple of people that don't know everything but have some experience with grass and grazing and sheep talk, they're more than welcome to join us for that.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. I feel like we only just touched on so many different topics that I want to delve into, but I'm so conscious of time. But fascinating, like, so good chatting to you.
It's been so fun. I really appreciate the invite, and it's so fun to talk about, production all over the place,
Oh,
and
absolutely.
your culture versus religion, topic. It's huge. I mean, it's everywhere. It transcends country borders. So it's
I
very
know,
cool.
absolutely. And I think as sheep producers, we're notoriously nosy. So I just think we like
Right.
knowing what everyone's doing, whether that's the neighbor physically next door or a neighboring country or wherever in the world. So no, thank you
Yeah.
so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you, Cameron. I know I learned so much from that. We'll include a link to his PhD in the show notes.